I don't think I've seen any open models yet. None of them are doing the things that we've traditionally associated with like a well-governed open source project.
I love that. Coming at it from the governance angle, I hadn't thought about that at all. That totally makes sense. Python's developer experience, people actually getting on board, it still isn't good enough. If somebody's trying to learn Python, they want to get it set up on their laptop, that's still too difficult.
There's still this perception around AI as far as, you know, it's going to take people's jobs, it's going to take over.
There are people whose jobs are threatened by AI. If you're an illustrator who works on commission, then the threat of people going to AI models is a very real threat. And it really sucks because the models were trained on your work without your permission, and now they're competing with you in the marketplace.
You have like truly one of the most unique backgrounds, from helping create the super popular Python web development framework Django, now Dataset. And you've also become sort of one of the most prominent voices in the AI ecosystem. And I'm actually very curious, just like from your journey perspective, like what was this like some sort of transition point, or like everything that's been happening in AI is just like an extremely natural extension of the work that you've been doing for the last, you know, 10 years?
So to me, it feels like a natural extension, because the theme of my entire career has always been, how do I build more stuff more quickly? Right. What are the things that I can use that will let me punch above my weight, like have more of an impact in the world, accelerate my development? And if you look at Django was that. Like, we built Django 21 years ago now. For the idea was web development on journalism deadlines. We wanted to be able to produce little web applications, support things in the news, where you have to turn them around within a couple of days because it takes you 6 months. The news story isn't relevant anymore. So that was really important to us. And then just open source in general. I think open source has been the single biggest productivity boost to software engineering of anyone's lifetime. I feel like today that's not really acknowledged so much, because developers, they have grown up with open source as a sort of default thing. 20 years ago, you had to convince companies to allow open source within their walls. You know, there were companies who had policies saying absolutely no open source code under any circumstances. Today, try writing any JavaScript at all with that policy in place, and it just won't work. So the theme for me has always been, what are tools that I can add to my tool belt that let me do more, that let me produce more and better code with the time that I have? And I got into large language models originally with GPT-3, when I realized that there were things that it could do that just massively accelerated me already, like using just the OpenAI Playground interface. I was doing things like getting it to write me little snippets of JQ code and so forth, and it worked really well. And so that upgraded JQ from a tool that I didn't use because I wasn't fluent in it to a tool that I was using a few times a week because I didn't have to learn the syntax anymore. And that's just kept on accelerating over the past 2.5 years. Like, I write AppleScript now. I deployed code written in Go with unit tests and continuous deployment and continuous integration, despite not being fluent in Go. That's quite a shocking thing to be able to do. And I love that. Like, I love AI as a accelerant in a sort of personal productivity improvement. I hate AI as a replacement for humans. I love it as a sort of cyborg enhancement for humans. And so I've been leaning really hard into that. And the ethics of the thing have always been so complicated. The ethics of how the training is so murky. There's so much about this that feels a little bit like cheating when you're using it as well, which is kind of interesting. So my way around that is, I said, okay, well, I'm going to help other people use it too. I'm going to be completely transparent in how I'm using these tools. I will write about them. I will share my prompts. And I already had a blog. I've had a blog for 20 years. So just leaning into that and saying, okay, well, I should start writing about this. And the weird thing is, very few people write about things on the internet in long form these days. So you can have an outsized influence on the world just by being the person that writes about a thing. You know, I've been writing, I started writing quite a lot about large language models again, maybe 2 years ago. And it's got me a long way. You know, it's got me invitations to all sorts of interesting things. I've met lots of people. I have developed I found myself in a semi-influential position in this industry just from sitting at home typing things up once or twice a week. That's pretty amazing. I would encourage other people to do that too. I don't want to be the only person who's writing about this stuff.
I love that. And can you actually just back through this thread of like how you're seeing the world and what you're doing? Like, how do you actually spend your time? Is it like, are you, I remember when we chatted last back in 2022, you were like in the process of creating a startup and doing that stuff. Is that like how you spend most of your time, or is it really spread out across a bunch of different stuff?
It's definitely spread across a bunch of different stuff. The problem I had is a few years ago, I got this opportunity to do the Stanford Journalism Fellowship, where it's a program called JSK Fellowships. They basically take mid-career journalists and they pay them to spend a year at Stanford on campus, hanging out with people and working on problems that are relevant to the news industry. It's deliciously vague. And I'm not a journalist, but I've done a lot of work at newspapers, like with journalists. So I managed to apply as the sort of wild card in the batch. And it completely ruined me because they paid me to spend a year working on whatever I wanted to work on. And once you've done that, it's very difficult to go back to other people telling you what to work on. And so what I've been trying to do, the goal is I want to turn all of my open source work into a sustainable full-time thing that employs not just me, but other people to work with me as well. The business model, I'm going after that one. I'm doing the paid hosting thing. So Dataset is open source. You can run it yourself. You can install it on a server. Or I'm building out Dataset Cloud, which is the pay me an amount of money a month and I will run it for your team with the plugins that you need, a private space, all of that kind of stuff. And that, I've been sort of previewing it and trying to figure out the right product mix for quite a while now. Getting very close. This week I've been hacking on Stripe integration to like fire up a payment page and all of that kind of stuff. But yeah, that's the goal there is effectively it's the WordPress model, right? WordPress has built a very successful business by being the best paid hosting for WordPress, despite the fact that WordPress is open source and freely available. And I want to do effectively the same thing, but for Dataset, which is almost like a WordPress for data, right? WordPress will solve any content publishing problem that you have. I want to build open source software with plugins that can solve any data analysis, visualization, and publication problem that you have. So if you want to share data with the world, I want Dataset to be the default tool for doing that.
I guess, you know, question kind of into that, I guess it kind of also goes into potentially some use cases, but I guess, you know, from Dataset being, or how is Dataset being utilized in AI projects, if it is, and then I guess, you know, what unique advantage does it offer from data exploration, but also sharing?
So Dataset's relationship with AI has been interesting. It's they started as the two worlds didn't really overlap, right? Dataset is a project I started around about 6 years ago. And the idea was take data that fits in a SQLite database, which is anything, because SQLite, you know, it's a database. It has JSON support and binary objects and so forth, and make it so you've got a web interface that lets you explore that data, publish that data online for other people, and then also interact with that data via a JSON API. So effectively, it's a out-of-the-box JSON API for anything that you can put in a SQLite database. Over time, as I built out this plugin system that lets plugins add extra features, I started growing more of the data manipulation features. So things for editing data, for geocoding things, for changing table schemas, that kind of thing. And that made me realize that it was effectively the problem I'm going after is data that's too big for Excel and that you want to share with other people, but that you don't really need to justify Postgres or like a data engineer working on it full time. There's people talk about big data a lot. I'm interested in small data, which I define as anything that fits on my phone, and my phone's got a terabyte of disk space. So small data, most companies don't actually have a terabyte of data, you know. So I think there's something really interesting about building out a sort of almost like the open source version of Microsoft Excel crossed with Airtable, which is an interesting field to be playing in. It's definitely it's ambitious, you know. And then the AI stuff, my earliest applications of Dataset to AI were just exploring training data. So when Stable Diffusion was released a couple of years ago, that was based on the Laion, L-A-I-O-N dataset. And I put up a dataset instance with all of the Laion data in so that people could search and see, oh, look, it all came from Pinterest and that kind of thing. So being able to explore those kinds of things. Anyone who works in AI will tell you that you have to get your hands dirty and look at the training data, and nobody ever wants to do it. So having an interface that helps people actually dig around in there is just inherently useful anyway. But then over the past 6 months, I've actually finally started bringing the two interests together and saying, okay, what are the AI-driven features that I can add to dataset? And I've got three of those that I've been experimenting with so far, all of them targeting this world of effectively data journalism as the frame that I'm looking at this. So that's effectively it's data science, but the kind that journalists do when they're working on investigative stories. And it's this wonderful field of this weird little niche field of computer science, which I've been involved with since the Django days. And so the three features I've got, firstly, there's the really obvious one. There's AI SQL assistance. You know, you type in a question in English. I look at the schema, I turn that into a SQL query, and I run that for you. The way I've been thinking about that, though, is in all of my experiments, I find that if you build the obvious version of that, like take the question, run the SQL query, use that to generate the answer, it gets it right 80% of the time. And 20% of the time, there's some kind of mistake in there. Like maybe it thought that the state column was CA, but it was actually California, or little things like that. So what I'm doing instead, I want to build an interface which shows it's working. So you ask a question, and instead of just getting an answer, you get bounced to a page with a SQL query. The SQL query is heavily commented. I've started experimenting with, like, what if I show you diagrams to help you understand which tables were joined together, pull out fragments of the tables so that you can see them, things like that. That's all quite early stages at the moment. But the key thing for me is, in journalism, the last thing you want is somebody publishing a story that's just got untrue things about the world in because their tooling let them down. Journalists are actually very good at this kind of thing. Like journalists, good news organizations have fact-checking. They have editorial teams. The best data teams that I've talked to actually, like they do code review on the data as part of that fact-checking process. So you can't publish something in, I think it was Reuters. If they put out a data-driven story, two separate data engineers have independently worked on those numbers and they've cross-checked their work. It's great, right? That's a responsible way of doing this. So I want to make sure that if you're a journalist who doesn't speak SQL and you use this tool and you get a result, you can send a link to your friend who does speak SQL and they can help you review what happened. Like things like that feel really important. So feature number one is ask questions of your data with SQL, which is sort of the obvious one. The one that I'm most excited about is structured data extraction. So if you're a journalist, you spend so much time trying to gather data for your stories. And it's garbage, right? It's government websites where you download a PDF and the PDF is a wonky, scanned, handwritten document from like 5 years ago and all of that kind of thing. And something that all of these models are getting really good at is you give them unstructured data, and it can be text or it can be images, and you give them a schema and say, you know, I want the name, address, and phone number that's represented in this document, and they pull those out. So I've built a feature for Dataset, again, as a plugin called Dataset Extract. And it lets you do exactly that. You can define a SQL, a table, because everything's a SQLite table in the end, that has name, address, and so forth. You can add hints like, I want the dates to be in year, 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 month, month, day, day. Then you paste data into it, or you drag and drop an image onto it, and you click a button, and it'll extract that data and stick it in a table for you. This is phenomenally effective. So far, I've mainly been doing it with GPT-4 Vision and GPT-4o. I've started playing GPT-4o Mini. The next step is to get it working against Claude and Gemini, because both of those, especially Gemini with its long context stuff, is particularly exciting for this. This is so cool. And I have friends who are like CEOs of AI companies who talk to lots of like Fortune 500 people, and they keep, he told me structured data extraction is actually the thing they care most about. Like these really big companies, it turns out everyone has this problem. Everyone has garbage unstructured data and they need to make sense of it. Being able to pipe that through a language model where the chance of things like hallucinations is a lot lower. It's not zero, but that you still have to do that sort of frustrating spot checking process, but it's such a huge time saver. So that's feature number two. And then the third feature is something I'm calling enrichments. And this is more of a general purpose idea where this started actually with geocoding, right? You've got a table full of addresses and you want a latitude and longitude column so you can plot it on a map. I built a enrichments feature where you can say, enrich this table, take this address column and turn it into a latitude and longitude. But that's built as plugins. So the first plugin was the geocoding plugin. The second plugin was the language model plugin. So you can say, okay, given this database table, take each row, template it in this way into this prompt, run the prompt and put the output of the prompt back in this column. And now you can do all sorts of things. This is like a human language data cleanup tool, which I think is really exciting. Like there's so much potential for that sort of thing. I'm working on versions of that where instead of the language model processing the rows, it writes code for you. So you can say, I need to drop all of the commas from this number and turn it into an integer. And the language model can then write a line of JavaScript that does that. The JavaScript then gets executed across 10 million rows. And so there's lots of potential for that kind of thing. Just code generation in general, I still feel is the most exciting, like the most valuable applications of things, weirdly, like nobody expected that when this technology first came out, that writing computer code was going to be one of its most powerful applications. But the idea that I can make those capabilities available to journalists who have never learned to program, but are data literate enough that they understand that you'd want to have a function that does X, Y, and Z, that's really cool. And that's one of the things I've been most excited about in the field of journalism is how do we take the kind of reporting that can only be done by the New York Times and the Washington Post because they can afford software engineers in their newsroom, how do we make that available to smaller publications? Like your local newspaper should be able to do data reporting against the latest like government salary database without having to bring a programmer in to do that analysis for them.
I think that's such a very interesting concept, like this data journalism. And I might, again, don't want to offend anyone here too, but I never really thought of journalists as people who are kind of getting in the weeds of buying data, using some code, you know, these different AI offerings. But it sounds like, again, your position is to provide that offering to individuals who might not have that technical experience.
Wow. And the thing I'll say about data journalism is it is it's a niche field. It is very vibrant. There's an annual conference called NICAR, which stands for the National Institute of Computer Assisted Reporting, because that's what they called data journalism back in the 70s when they started doing it, right? There are people at this conference who remember mainframes, right? Because they've been doing this kind of stuff for that long. And that conference, I go every year, there's like 1,000 people and they are all nerds like me, basically. Like all sorts of different backgrounds and interests and geographies, but fundamentally they're people who want to dig into data and find stories in it. And I love that, right? That's, again, Django has been a big part of that over the years as well. But that idea that you can, because there are stories in the data. Like my favorite example, the city of San Francisco has an open data portal where you can download like city data. One of the files on there is a CSV file of every tree in San Francisco. And there are 195,000 trees and they update it every day of the week. You can go and you'll see last updated today because they added 3 trees and removed 5 other trees. And they've got the latitude and longitude, the address, who owns it, who looks after it, what species of tree it is, when it was planted, right? Really rich data. There are stories in there, right? Which neighborhoods get the most trees? Which neighborhoods, which kinds of trees are more likely to be removed after a certain amount of time? There's so much in there. Of course, nobody's telling those stories because what the hell are you supposed to do with a CSV file of 195,000 trees that changes every day? So that's what I want to solve. I want to build software that means that a reporter who, again, is data literate, they know their way around Excel, but they're not necessarily like writing Python code. I want them to be able to tell a story based on that weird tree database.
Simon, why frame this? And maybe this is just my assumed framing, but like why build, you know, like an open source tool for this use case versus like something more of like a consumer application, right, where sort of you abstract away all the technical detail and it's really sort of, you know, throw in a data set and ask questions.
So the original reason is that I was building this as a side project. And I know from past experience that if your side project has user accounts, that's not a side project. That's like an unpaid job. So originally when I built DataSet, I'm like, it's going to be open source. People are going to have to install it themselves. I am not responsible for anyone resetting anyone's password or anything like that. And that worked for the first couple of years when it was just a side project. But it was a massive barrier to the people I most wanted to use it, like newsrooms, telling the newsroom, oh, it's easy. Just get a new Ubuntu VPS and then apt-get install Python 3 and then do this and then do that. You've lost them, right? So the people I most wanted to use my software were... So eventually, I had to admit that I'm going to have user accounts, right? I need to host this for other people. And I also, it's a proven business model for open source is charging people money per month for the SaaS version. So once I was full time on it, that became a lot more sort of feasible to do. I tried a bunch of other things first. Like I built a desktop application version of DataSet using an Electron app so that people wouldn't have to install Python and figure out how pip install works and all of those kinds of things. I managed to get it running in WebAssembly. So there's a version of DataSet that runs entirely in a browser using Python, the pyre-dyed Python WebAssembly thing. Super cool. I built it basically as a sort of experiment to see if it was possible, thinking nobody will ever use this because it has to download like 5 megabytes of stuff just to boot up. Turns out in 2024, 5 megabytes is fine. That's like most React homepages. So the fact that you're loading an entire Python interpreter into the user's browser isn't the blocker I thought it was going to be. And so actually quite a lot of people are using the web browser based version of my server-side Python app, which is quite amusing. But yeah, so, and then the other thing is it has to be open source, because the news industry is enough trouble already. If I get them hooked on a proprietary tool and then shut it down, I've just caused even more harm, right? That's been very important to me from the very start, is I want this project to have longevity and I want people to be able to trust it. When initially it was just me hacking on my laptop, I think open source is an amazing way to build that trust. I've had situations in my career where I picked a commercial open source thing, the company went out of business, and we kept on using the software because we could, because we had that escape clause. And I wanted to make sure, and also in news, news is an awful industry to build a startup in, because newspapers don't have any money. So, and my plan is not to, I do not intend to make money from the news industry in the long term. My theory is any software I build that helps journalists tell stories with data is valuable to everyone else on the planet who has data and wants to tell stories with it. Like, there's nothing I could build for a journalist that wouldn't also be useful for a corporate strategy department or quants or all of these different categories of people. So I'm not worried about sort of pigeonholing myself into an industry that doesn't make any money, because I think the stuff I'm building is applicable way wider than that.
I love that perspective. I'm also curious, like, it seems like, again, I think you're uniquely suited to answer this question, given your perspective on sort of how developers have been building with different tools over the last 20 years. But do you have a sense of, specifically on the AI front, like, it seems like every time there's a new model or a new thing, like, the developer willingness right now to try that thing or build with it or adopt a new tool is incredibly high. And it's not like my instinct a year ago was that, like, we basically have like a year worth of attention where people are just eventually going to burn out. They're not really interested in trying the new thing. But it feels like somehow that hasn't slowed down. And if anything, it's accelerated, and maybe the ecosystem has just expanded. But do you think I'm curious if there's like a time bound for when people are just gonna be like, okay, you know what? This model was really good. This tool is really good. I'm done trying all the new stuff. Like, just give me the thing that works so I don't have to think about this anymore.
That's a really interesting question. I mean, I'm probably not so qualified to answer this because I've always been an early adopter. Like, I will try new things. Again, I'm sort of interviewing things to add them into my toolbox overall. And I mean, evaluating models is so difficult, right? Like, a new model comes out. How am I supposed to tell if it is incrementally better for the things that I'm doing than the model I was using previously? And I've got another sort of weird little open source side project that I might start pointing at that. There's an evals tool. I'd rather not build one. I'm hoping that somebody else solves that problem really well before I have to take a look at it. Well, this is, so my other big open source project, I've got two major projects right now. I've got Dataset, which we've talked about. My other one is this package called LLM, and it's a command line Python tool for working with language models, which started initially, it was just for working with OpenAI. I wanted to be able to basically pipe files on my terminal into GPT-4 and say, do this thing with them. And so I built that and it was really fun. And then because I've built plugin systems before for Dataset, I thought, well, wouldn't it be interesting if you could install plugins into this thing and add extra models? And I got that working. And now there's like 200 plus models that are available through this single tool if you install plugins. Some of them are API models like OpenAI and Anthropic. Some of them are local models using like llama.cpp. So you can actually pip install Llama onto your laptop now with my tool, which is really fun. Like there's a few little edge cases around that. But that's been really interesting because, and the other feature of this tool is that anything you do that gets logged to a SQLite database. So SQLite is kind of the substrate that all of my tools interoperate through. And it means that I can do research just by mucking around in my terminal, and anything that I try against any model gets logged in my SQLite database, which is now like 90 megabytes of recorded prompts and responses across 100 different models. And so theoretically, I can then analyze that and say, okay, given this prompt against these different models, how did that work out? I haven't actually been doing that at all. I've been hoarding the data without doing the analysis step. But that's always on the cards. So This also gives me an abstraction layer against different models, which is great, right? I can run the same prompt against GPT-4 and then against Claude 3.5 Sonnet and then against Gemini 1.5 Pro just by changing the -m flag in the thing that I'm typing on my in the command line. So then my evals project is a plugin for LLM that adds a new command to LLM, which lets you, at the moment, the idea is that you can run a whole bunch of prompts that are defined in a YAML file. So you'll have an eval, which is a YAML file full of prompts and little assertions, things like it should have the word Paris in the thing that came back so that you can test if what's the capital of France gave back the correct answer. I haven't actually touched that project in a couple of months. I'm finding time for it amongst everything else. But I like the idea that I want to be able to hoard my own evals and quickly run them against new models. And I want to be able to share them with other people. So I can download your YAML file of like your favorite math question prompts and quickly execute those and see how those go. That's the sort of ambitious version of that. I honestly don't, with the other things I've got going on, I don't know if I'll have time to put more effort into that before somebody else solves the problem better. And that would be great.
Simon, I guess as someone who is not only building, but obviously very active in the open source ecosystem, I was going through some of your tweets prior to hopping on, and I think there was one that was kind of, you know, summarizing Mark Zuckerberg's something around Meta's open source model, or, you know, them trying to build on open source. And, you know, I think the comment that you made is, how do we get organizations to stop misusing the word open source? So yeah, I guess kind of from your perspective, you know, what are you seeing in that space? You know, how do we combat that? You know, again, yeah, as someone who's building in that space, would love to get your thoughts specifically on, because it's a huge buzzword. Everyone's talking about open source. All these models are coming out.
Like, this is a totally pedantic thing for me, but it does matter to me. The problem is, if you tell me something is open source, if you're sticking to the opensource.org definition of that, that's useful information for me. I can be like, okay, I know my rights with regards to this software, and I can build on it without having to go and call my lawyer and get them to review a custom license, all of that kind of thing. Some of the open source models, like most of the Mistral models, are under an Apache 2 license. That's fine. I know what I can do with it. Things like the Llama 3 and the Llama 3.1 license, they're not open source because they have those additional clauses. And the additional clauses seem relatively inoffensive. Like, one of them is, you can't use this model without a license if you had more than 700 million active users the day the model was released, which sounds like it's a, that just means no Alibaba, no Apple, no Microsoft, whatever. Except the question I have is, if I do a startup and it's successful and then I want to sell my startup to Apple, does that license clause suddenly kick in and now Meta get to veto my startup acquisition because Apple have more than 700 million users? Now, the answer to that question might be no, it's completely irrelevant, but I have to get a lawyer to help me understand that. So that is my aversion to having to ask lawyers questions is what one of the reasons this matters to me so much personally. And then there's the larger argument that people make is, it's not open source if you don't get the source code such that you can rebuild it. And for a model, the source code is the training data. And obviously you can't open source the training data because it's all unlicensed stuff that's been scraped off of the web. That one, I respect that opinion. I don't use that as my own personal definition because my definition is I don't have to call my lawyer and ask them questions about the license. So that's my sort of selfish take on that. There's an interesting conspiracy theory about why Meta slapped the label open source on things that aren't, which is that if you look at the European Union's AI Act, it specifically carves things out for open source models, but it doesn't say a definition of what an open source model is. So there may be an incentive right now for anyone who's got something even remotely open source to say it's definitely open source because there's legislation being written that uses that term in an inaccurate way. And that's, again, it's a theory I've heard. It sounds all right to me, but I'm not an international lawyer, so I couldn't tell you for sure if that's what's going on. But yeah, so that's why I care. I care because if you tell me something's open source and it really is, I can skip a whole bunch of like concern over that license. And most of these open source licenses that aren't, those I still have to think about them.
Have you been engaging at all with keeping an eye on the conversation that OSI has been driving around trying to define what open source AI means? I know they've been putting a ton of effort into this, but they're still early.
I had a conversation with them in January just about my very loosely formed opinions, pretty much what I just said to you now, and I've not followed it since then. So I do know that work is happening, and I'm looking forward to seeing the results of it. But yeah, I've not been following it closely.
Yeah, I'm really optimistic that they will help do this. I think my personal opinion, and I think like me and Nolan both work at NumFocus and spend a bunch of time thinking about the sustainability of open source. It feels like the open source AI ecosystem has actually been like a net negative to the broad movement of open source, because people are conflating, you know, what right. people had historically called like source available. Like I have an open model that I can use that's source available. It's like the final .exe file versus like an actual sustainable distributed governance, distributed, you know, community of people who are built around an open source project. And it's funny that I don't think I've seen any open source projects or any open models yet that would sort of meet the threshold of like actually becoming a NumFocus project, because of the fact that none of them are doing the things that we traditionally associated with like a real well-governed open source project.
I love that. Coming at it from the governance angle, is I hadn't thought about that at all. That totally makes sense. Yeah, that's really interesting.
Again, I think it's almost, to Logan's point, a disadvantage. You know, you have all these large organizations who are talking about open source, the importance of open source. And then again, from my perspective, which is, you know, tasked with trying to get funds back to the tools in which they use, you know, no one ever has money allocated to supporting the open source ecosystem, which is ironic. And even from past creators or founders that we've spoken to on previous episodes, you know, it's interesting to see that it's been stated that open source is a competitive advantage. So being able to, you know, put your stuff out there, learn from it, obviously have a number of eyes and resources allocated to these open source tools is interesting. Again, I think we're in a very interesting space. And I think as it continues to get pushed out there, hopefully the definition becomes more clear for folks. Mm-hmm. But yeah, definitely still a little bit sticky as far as what that looks like.
Also, the frustration that you now have, it's getting political and there are legislators saying, we should ban open source. And you're like, oh, that is so not how this was supposed to play out. You know, this is the abuse of the term is getting into some very scary rhetorical arguments these days.
And I believe it was Australia, right? There was a country, yeah, someone who basically mandated that all organizations, I think it was, have open source in their code. Or yeah, I sorry for butchering it, but I know Australia did something.
If my taxpayer money plays for code, stick it on GitHub. That's that one I'm quite. I like that that's beginning to at least be talked about in some places.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm curious from one of the hats that you wear is the work that you do with the Python Software Foundation. I'm curious what your reaction to this is, but it feels like for a very long time, and maybe this is my bias from being in the Julia community and sort of some other trying to push a bunch of languages that weren't Python. I think Python's an incredible ecosystem, but it feels like LLMs have actually been perhaps unintuitively to me, sort of an accelerant or the sort of cementing layer of Python as sort of the canonical language that everyone is going to use and build with, mostly because like a lot of the tools and the model is so good, the models are so good at generating Python code, but also like Code Interpreter and a bunch of these other things are actually like running Python behind the scenes, which is sort of further accelerating the distribution of Python to people who previously weren't using Python. I'm curious what your reaction to that is. Like, is this something positive for the ecosystem? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's also PyTorch, right? PyTorch is the default tool that all of these models are being built in. That's Python ecosystem stuff. Yeah. It's interesting, right? Like, I am a Python and JavaScript programmer. And the training data for Python and JavaScript massively outweighs everything else. So these models are incredibly good at Python and JavaScript. So as a person who uses this language, I get a massive boost myself, like bigger than if I was using Rust primarily or even Go. Those ecosystems aren't as known by the LLMs. And then in terms of teaching people to program, Python has always been... And Python started out, it evolved out of an education-based language many, many years ago. It's always had a very strong helping people to learn to program thing. And that's sort of, that's definitely being accelerated by things like Code Interpreter, by a lot of these tools I've noticed some of these models default to answering in Python when you ask a generic code question, even though you didn't say what language you wanted. The flip side is Python's developer experience for people actually getting onboarded still isn't good enough. I think that's the single biggest weakness of the language is if somebody's trying to learn Python, they want to get it set up on their laptop, that's still too difficult. And that and figuring out dependencies and all of that kind of stuff, the system works fantastically once you've climbed that initial learning curve, but the initial learning curve is a little bit steeper. It's quite a bit steeper than I want it to be. And so the PSF, I'm on the board of directors of the Python Software Foundation. One of the initiatives that we're sparking up at the moment is around that. It's around the onboarding and the education and just help making sure that when you go to python.org, you get the best possible set of instructions on how to get started in this language. That really matters to me. One of the things I love about Code Interpreter is that you don't have to install Python to use it, right? And that's amazing. You know, that's something that keeps on happening. I mentioned Pyodide earlier, the Python and WebAssembly thing. Again, phenomenal, right? You can fire up a full Jupyter like data science environment in your browser on a phone even. I mean, the UI doesn't quite work on a phone, but it does, but this stuff is possible. So there's a lot of great things around that. But yeah, I think the Python community's biggest responsibility now is to carve down that initial learning curve and make sure that people who want to learn to program can get started as smoothly as possible.
Yeah, I have two really quick follow-up questions. One, do you think that because of LLMs, it will actually sort of, on one hand, Python is getting really good because there's so much data around it. But on the other hand, the LLM itself could be a really interesting accelerant for new languages or things like that, because you can actually sort of like auto create, you know, all of the blog posts, all of the possible questions that one could have, and like preemptively put that content out in the world. Where, like, again, this was the challenge for us in the Julia ecosystem, was like, you know, there was a lot of questions that people didn't know the answer to. And just like the act of someone asking the first question could oftentimes be really, really difficult. I'm curious, you think the LLMs could sort of help? And like DataSet as an example, like, have you thought about like how to get more content out there so that the LLMs are better at it and stuff like that?
I mean, there's this idea that keeps on cropping up, the idea that you can take a program language library and try and create the best possible 50,000 token prompt that teaches the LLM enough about that library that it can then answer questions using it. I've not actually seen a really great implementation of that idea yet, which surprises me, because it feels like I'd love to have the copy and paste this chunk into, or here's a Claude project or a GPT or something that's been preceded with this. So that I find really exciting. I love your idea there that maybe this does lower the barrier to launching a new language, because launching a new programming language is so hard, right? Like you said, you need the standard library for it. It can take 10 years to evolve before it can do all of the things you need a language to do out of the box. And then on top of that, there's the educational material. And maybe this does make that faster. Maybe if I invented a programming language tomorrow, I could knock out the URL parsing library in like 5 minutes, because the language model, once it's figured out enough of that language, could help me do that. So I'd love to see it. I love the idea that there's just generally the idea that somebody might build a programming language which is specifically good for language models. Like, it uses less tokens. It's easier for the models to get their matrix brains around. I think that felt more exciting a couple of years ago. Today, the models are so powerful that it doesn't feel like you need to optimize your language to work better with the model. It'll figure out pretty much anything. But yeah, no, that's interesting. I'd love to see a new programming language that used language models to accelerate its adoption and its the development of its standard libraries and so on. That could be really cool.
Simon, I feel like if there's anyone who's positioned to do that, it sounds like this is a good gig for you. So
absolutely not. I'm not going to do a PhD. I'm not going to invent a programming language. Like, those are off the table.
Yeah, my sort of side comment to this is, and this is hopefully as shameless of a shameless plug for at least thinking about long context to be the solution to this problem. In the Gemini 1.5 technical report, the DeepMind team shared an example of how you can take a low resource language that essentially is not represented on the internet or in training data and put the dictionary and like not many shot example, but like 100,000 shot example mm-hmm. of what it might look like to use that language and actually get human level performance on that language just through fully in context learning.
And that's a human language, right?
Like, yeah, in a human language.
Wow, that's, I can believe it. That's fascinating.
So it sounds like you have your third open source project.
Yeah, I'm maintaining over 250 projects at the moment. In terms of, if somebody reports a bug, I will fix that bug and they will ship a release. Most of them are tiny. They're like little plugins for DataSet that add one little feature. Like having a plugin ecosystem for a tool is such a great way of doing open source, because somebody who wants a feature in one of my tools can just build it as a plugin, and they don't even have to talk to me, and they don't have to code review it, and they can ship it to PyPI, and people can start using it. Now, I was completely hands-off on the whole thing. And that's amazing, right? You can wake up in the morning and your software grew a new feature overnight. And if that feature sucks, it doesn't matter, because people can just not install that plugin. So like I build, a lot of my plugins are quite frankly terrible ideas that I built as a plugin, as an experiment, because there's no risk to the integrity of the core project. If I ship a dumb feature in the core project, I have to maintain it for the next forever. That's bad, right? But if it's a little plugin, who cares? It's fine.
Simon, one of the things I love about the conversations we have on this podcast with you and other people in the space, you know, everyone's creating and building these phenomenal tools that seem to be extremely helpful to developers, individuals, whatever the case might be. But I think that, again, there's still this perception around AI as far as, you know, it's going to take people's jobs, it's going to take over. And I saw one of your tweets, which I think was quoted as, AI assistance makes programming knowledge and skill more valuable, not less.
Yes.
We'd love to kind of hear your thoughts on that, and also how you kind of combat. I'm sure you talked to, you know, hundreds and hundreds of individuals around these tools and how to implement them and kind of, you know, calm them down around the fact of, again, it's not here to replace you, it's here to help you, and this is exactly how. So I think it obviously comes back to a lot of the educational resources that you provide. But yeah, curious to get your thoughts on that and share.
So this is a complex issue, right? Because there are people whose jobs are threatened by AI and it's weird. Like if you're an illustrator who works on commission, then the threat of people going to AI models to like Stable Diffusion stuff instead is a very real threat. And it really sucks because the models were trained on your work without your permission, and now they're competing with you in the marketplace. Like, I think that'll probably end up shaking out as fair use and legal, but it still sucks from a moral point of view if that happens to you. So I won't say universally AI is not a threat to people. My hope is that in almost all of these cases, there is a thing you can move into, which is taking all of the skills and experience you had beforehand and using and your ability to use these models, which mean that you're better at them. Like, I would much rather work with a professional illustrator who uses image generation models to produce great art than a rank amateur who's using the same models. Same thing. And for programming, it's the same thing, right? Somebody who doesn't know how to program can use Claude 3.5 Artifact to produce something useful. Somebody who does know to program will do it better and faster, and they'll ask better questions of it, and they will produce a better result. And that, so I don't feel threatened by, as a professional programmer, I don't feel threatened by these things because I know I can use them better than almost anyone else based on my 20 years of programming experience. You know, I can absolutely fly with Code Interpreter and with Claude Artifacts and so forth, because I've got 20 years of experience in what's possible, what isn't possible, what traps to avoid, all of that sort of stuff. And so you hear people saying, I've quit my computer science degree. There's no point in me learning programming. This career is dead end. It's all going to be replaced. That really upsets me, because I genuinely feel like as a sort of senior software engineer, the time I spend typing code into a computer is about 10% of my work. And that work is like 2 to 5 times more productive now with language models, which is great. You know, I've massively accelerated that 1/10 of my work that's actually the bit where I type the code. But everything else, the figuring out what needs to be built, researching what the options are, talking to users, talking to stakeholders, communicating things to other developers, I get little bits and pieces of boosts from AI there as well. But that's, again, based on my existing experience, knowing that these are the kinds of things that the models are useful for, these are the kinds of things that they aren't useful for. Something I keep on coming back to is that I think language models are incredibly difficult to use as a piece of technology, and I don't think that's acknowledged nearly enough. Like, how hard is it to type something into ChatGPT? Surely anyone can do that. The problem is that to get the really good results out of them, you have to have quite a deep understanding of them. You have to understand training cutoff dates and why can't a language model count the number of letters in a word? And all of that, there are all of these very unintuitive things that they can't do well. Like, they can't count and they can't do maths. It's a computer system that can't multiply two large numbers together. That's inherently absurd to people. But it can do all of this other stuff. And so building up that intuition as to this is an appropriate task for a language model and this isn't takes a long time. Like, I'm still learning new tricks and I've been using them on a daily basis for 2 years now. So I feel like Firstly, developing expertise in language models is not as easy as people think it is. And secondly, if you're going to use them to build great software, there's way more to great software than just typing in the prompt and copying, pasting code out. So if you want to learn to program right now, I think language models accelerate you enormously. Like that learning curve I talked about with Python, ChatGPT will help you get over that. If you get an error message from a missing semicolon and paste it into ChatGPT, it'll tell you what to do. Whereas previously, you could have been stuck for like an hour scratching your head over what this weird thing meant. So I love that. I think that there has never been a better time to start learning to program because these tools are available to shave down that learning curve to help you move so much faster. And the value that you can provide is so much more, right? Like me as a experienced programmer with LLM assistance, I can build stuff I couldn't have built before. Like if you hire me, you will get more for your money than if I didn't have access to those tools. My hope is that that then increases the size of the market for programming skills. And this is where I'm uncertain. Like if we make every programmer 2 to 5 times more productive, does that mean we need half the number of programmers? Or does it mean that companies that previously would not have commissioned custom software because they couldn't afford to hire a team of 5 to work for 6 months on it, they can now hire a team of 2 to work for 1 month on it? Does that mean that now all of these companies are saying, you know what, we will commission programmers to build that software for us? My optimistic hope is that it's the second one. Like the pool of, there's like, what company has ever said, wow, we've got enough programmers now. We can solve all of our problems, you know? So ideally, I would like to see this open up so many more opportunities for people who use compute, who automate computers to solve problems in people's lives. Like that's fundamentally what we're doing as programmers. That's never going to go away as a thing that we need to do. That's my optimistic version of that.
I love that perspective, Simon. I completely agree with you. It seems like the more developed, there's an infinite amount of software that needs to be created in the world, and like people are always going to, it's an exciting time to be a developer. On this thread of like, you mentioned how much more productive the models are making you today, which I think is like, I feel that as well. And I think there's a lot of people who feel that. I do think there's a ton of rough edges still with models. And I'm curious, like if you had your magic Simon wand and you can sort of wave it and, you know, the top three problems that you would solve from like a core LLM perspective.
So my biggest one, and this is that from the data journalism angle, is I need a version that has the safety filters turned off. And the reason I need that is that if you're a journalist, like, you work with horrible sources of information, right? You're tracking you're reading fascist message boards, trying to figure what they're up to. You're dealing with reports of police violence, all of these different kinds of things. And right now, sometimes you will feed some stuff like you will feed material for reporting into a language model, and it will refuse to answer your question. I had the best version of this happen to me I was doing a live demo at a journalism conference in front of 100 journalists. And I had a campaign finance report, this like crap, like scanned document with handwritten numbers about what somebody's political donations. I fed it into Claude 3 Opus and said, extract the data from this as JSON. And Claude 3 Opus said, I'm not comfortable doing this. This campaign finance report has personal, private financial information. I don't want to. I will not do this for you. Live on stage in front of journalists. It was a brilliant moment, right? It's like roars of laughter, really, really funny. But it emphasizes that if we've got this technology and we can use it to extract campaign finance reports, which is a really valid thing to do, and sometimes it just says no to you, that's really frustrating, right? That gets in the way. I talked to a journalist who'd been analyzing footage from police body cameras using Gemini actually. And they said that one of the things they had to do is remind the model that dogs bite people, because police dogs sometimes bite people. But models are kind of like tuned on the internet idea that all dogs are good dogs and no dog has ever bitten anyone, which is just very entertaining. But this is a problem, right? And so with my journalism hat on, I've had conversations with people at like Anthropic and OpenAI and Google saying, hey, how about an unfiltered model? And they don't say it out loud, but I think what goes through their head is, why would we give journalists access to an unfiltered model? They're just going to write stories about it, writing Nazi manifestos and stuff, right? Like, that it's difficult to make the case that news organizations should get privileged access to unfiltered models and what we sort of pinky promised that we won't write any stories about it. Yeah, it's complicated. But yeah, that's the thing I really want. I'm kind of hoping that like Llama 3.1, somebody will put up a fine tune on Hugging Face with the safety filters turned off that will turn out to be really useful for journalism.
I love that, Simon. Just to be respectful of your time, me and Nolan always like to close with two questions. So I'll tee up the first one. I'll let Nolan tee up the second one. Can you just tell us about like what your personal AI productivity stack looks like today? Like what tools you're using, yep. Anything custom you built, all that good stuff.
So right now, my personal stack is I spend time in ChatGPT for code interpreter. I spend time in Claude. Claude 3.5 Sonnet is currently my default model for most things. And I use it for artifacts, which I use to generate. I'm like building way more HTML JavaScript features than I used to because I can have it knock out an artifact prototype and then copy and paste that into my work. That's kind of fun. I use my LLM command line tool on a daily basis for things like cat this Python file in and add type annotations, all of that kind of stuff. I'm using VS Code with GitHub Copilot. And that's basically it. It's ChatGPT, Claude, LLM, and Copilot. I run this app called MLC Chat on my phone, which runs models on my phone, mainly for demos to show people. But I've used it on airplanes occasionally because it knows enough Python that it can answer like questions about things I've forgotten.
And then the last question we like to ask is, it's crazy, it's already August. So we got 5 months left in 2024. But I guess, you know, in the remainder of 2024, maybe a little bit into 2025, something that you're excited or hopeful about, and then also something that potentially you hope gets pushed or does not come to fruition based on any reasons you might have yourself.
So I don't want AGI. I'm frustrated that all of the big AI labs, like at least 60% of them appear to be very much AGI pilled, and you know, we're going to build digital God. And I don't really care. Like I'm scared not of AGI, I'm scared of what happens to society when so much disruption happens all in one go. I have trouble imagining that like universal basic income or something will come along and save us from the societal upheavals from that. So that I'm not particularly interested in. And also like I get frustrated about the amount of discussion in the space that's around these sort of science fiction ideas that distracts from the sort of practicalities of what you can do. My focus has always been, what can the models I have in my hand right now do that's useful? Because that way I can just sort of I can duck out of all of the sort of futuristic conversations. That's the thing I'm not excited about. The thing I am excited about, honestly, just I love the incremental improvement on these models is so exciting. The fact that like we do seem to be leveling off a little bit in this kind of GPT-4 capabilities, but still like 3.5 Sonnet came along and was better, like notably better for my stuff. Apparently, you know, I need to check out the latest Gemini 1.5 from a couple of days ago. I'm so excited about Claude 3.5 Haiku, because I'm assuming it's going to be priced the same as Claude Haiku and is going to be outrageously useful. I love these fast and cheap models that are increasingly coming out. And then the other thing is that the local models I can run on my laptop, like I've been running local models for over a year now, and they've never been very good. Like they sort of begin to get to sort of GPT 3.5 level. They've just had a massive leap forward in the past few weeks. Like the past month, it feels like people have found optimization techniques where you can have an 8B model that runs on my laptop that's actually beating GPT 3.5. And so I'm really interested to see where that goes. Like maybe with a few more, like the binary quantization techniques or something, do I get to a point where my next Mac can run a GPT-4 class model locally? Like that, we might get there, and that would be really exciting.
I love that. We just released Gemma 2, the 2B version, which outscores 3.5 Turbo on a bunch of stuff, and you can run it on your phone locally. And I'm like, this is crazy. Like, this is like, if you would ask people how long it would take for some of those original 3.5 level models to like actually make it onto the device, I think most people would have guessed that it was going to be a really long time.
Right, because I didn't think you could shrink them. I thought GPT 3.5 model was too big to run on a consumer laptop. And it turns out with the optimizations from Gemma 2 and such like it, that's just not true. You can do it. So yeah, I love that. I'm also, I don't care if my model knows who the King of France was in 1782. I want my model to be able to summarize text and generate code and know when to use tools and all of those kinds of things. And it's interesting. Like I think 5.3, the paper specifically said, it doesn't know that much about the world. Like, it doesn't know facts about the world, but it can do these other things. That's what I want, right? I want a model on my computer that knows when to run a search against Bing or whatever, and that knows when to, but otherwise can just do tool usage and summarization. And that feels like it's getting closer as well. I think we're basically there now. I can get a model on my laptop that can do useful things and doesn't know everything that's known about the world in Wikipedia, and that's fine.
Yeah, Simon, I love this. Hearing your perspective is incredibly interesting. I'm glad we got a chance to have you on. Thank you for taking the time. And hopefully folks enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you greatly, Simon.